Microphone.
Without going to a lot of detail state by state, 28 states,
yeah,
I'll just mention two. It's, one not typical, and that was Utah, which was the first state in which there was a major contest. And the reason there was a major contest in Utah was a strategic decision by the banking industry, because Senator Gahn, who was chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, was from Utah. And presumably their strategy was that if they could get repressive legislation in Utah, it would convince Senator Gahn that there was a public groundswell, which he could then translate onto the national scene. Also, there was pending in Utah, by coincidence, a general banking reform bill, which was, in general terms, was a much-needed update to Utah's banking laws and not no longer controversial. All its details have been worked out, etc., and the bill was ready for passage. And so all that was done was to put in an amendment to the bill, which would have had the effect of killing money market funds in the state. Unfortunately, this surfaced in Utah without our knowing about it in Washington, and had been bubbling along for 3 or 4 weeks publicly before we found out about it. And the people most involved were Merrill Lynch in Utah, and the attack had been on Merrill Lynch's money market fund, and it was being handled by Merrill Lynch's lobbyists in Utah in a way which we had already decided one could not win a lobbying battle against the banks and SNLs. And therefore, Merrill Lynch was very much in a losing position, and also Merrill Lynch in Utah represented Wall Street, and so this is not in a lot of the country a very favorable image to project. So when we found out about it, the first thing I thought we had to do was to take out the image that this is merely Frankenstein versus Godzilla. Get it away, leave the Frankenstein in the picture, and but divert attention elsewhere. Now, a Washington-based trade association is not necessarily cannot necessarily portray itself as a man of the people. The image is not generally sympathetic. But all things considered, I thought that the best thing to do was just to get it away from banks versus Merrill Lynch. And so we particularly try to draw attention to ourselves. Basically, we then took over the the fight in Utah. We, of course, had to retain local lobbyists in each state who would always tell us at the beginning, you're dead. No one ever beats the banks and SNLs. Usually they're fighting with each other. And here they've combined against you, and we can arrange an honorable surrender. But that's it. And, you know, we would have to say, that's not what we hired you for. We just want to know the way to the state capitol, who the players are, and et cetera. And in Utah, we found that it was possible to reach the head of the largest indigenous Utah bank, the Zion National Bank, who was relied upon by leading Utah businesses and had strong connections, Mormon connections in Utah. And it was arranged to have a meeting with the president of the bank. This was purely one-on-one, and it was extremely interesting. One of the things he said to me right off the bat was, look, I stay awake at night thinking that we can only pay our depositors 5% when real interest rates are 15%. And it's just not a wholesome situation. On the other hand, I can't turn my back on all the other bankers, small bankers around the state, who will see their deposits cannibalized by money market, taken out by money market funds. And the banks had spread certain rumors about dealers who were unscrupulous people taking money out of banks and putting them in these fly-by-night mutual funds. And there was one dealer they kept on mentioning, and fortunately I had heard about this and found out the actual circumstances. And when the president of the bank brought this up, I was able to straighten it out. He swiveled around, got his branch manager in the city, and said, John Doe, the name of this dealer, what do we know about him? Yes, yes, yes. Hung up, swiveled back, and said, you're right, we lend him money on his signature. And that eased things off, and he finally said, well, look, I told you, I can't and I won't desert the bankers, the state, but we'll stay neutral. And I thanked him. The other great event, in two more great events in Utah, was by this time, old Senator Bennett had retired from the Senate and still occupied otherwise vacant downtown offices of the Bennett Paint Company, his old family business. And I found out that he was an outside director of the Waddell and Reed funds in Kansas City, and he was the director of a money market fund. So I went to see him, and I was scheduled to testify before the Utah legislature the next day. And it was really an invitation to a lynching. I was there was no question about what was going to happen when I testified. And Senator Bennett kindly agreed to accompany me to the hearing and introduce me to the committee. And this was one of the great surprises that we were able to spring on anybody, because here the lynch mob was formed, and I come walking down to sit down with probably the most respected political statesman in the state, who gave me the usual effusive Washington, D.C. introduction, making it sound like we went back about 70 years together. I made my three-minute statement. They asked me two pro forma questions and got me out of there. The second was that the Utah legislature, I remember which branch, it was the Senate or the House, I think, met as a committee of the whole on occasion, and they would take outside people making statements. We found a retired school teacher who had been the third grade teacher for about half the people in the state legislature, and came in and gave them a lecture. I have a 2-minute tape here somewhere. He gave a 2-minute lecture on how they were going to take her retirement income away from her if they threw away money market funds. Anyway, the great vote came. They have machine voting in their house. And it was like a tote board. And it was like, I don't know how many minutes it could stay open. And the vote total was going up and back. Nobody knew how the Speaker of the House felt about all this, because he was the one that pressed the button. And we were ahead by 2 votes when he pressed the button and killed the bill in Utah. And they had to come to us to resurrect the banking bill. This was the whole banking bill which went down to defeat. After that, our intelligence became much better, because it became nationally known. And as the efforts would start by sneaking bills in, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in some cases we'd get a reporter who would call the ICI and say, "There's something, you interested in money market fund legislation?" In other cases, and this is interesting, on the state level, the securities regulator is very often subordinate or is a branch of the bank regulatory body. And so when the bankers were busy formulating anti-money market fund legislation, they would call in the securities administrator to find out exactly what dosage of poison to mix, to put it that way, that would effectively kill money market funds easily and expeditiously. In a couple of cases, we then got calls from the state securities administrator, who would go outside to a telephone booth and tip us off as to what was going on. One other state I'll mention, because this went on in 20 states. Kentucky was an interesting one. Our first pitch would always be to the chairman of the ranking committee in the state with jurisdiction over this matter, to say, "Look, you may not understand what this bill really does. It doesn't regulate money market funds. It puts them out of business." And in Kentucky, I met this fellow with very, very cold eyes, looked at me and said, "I hope so." So that drew the battle lines in Kentucky, and we, again, followed the usual pattern. I'd send in three or four people with credit cards, because local radio stations want cash when you give them advertising. And in some states, I'd have to start them off in various sections of the state, crisscrossing by road with their American Express cards, delivering copy to the radio stations. And we could blanket the state very, very quickly. I think in Iowa, we did it so quickly, and these ads were read by DJs on the radio, that we saw the next morning, the local television news would picked up pictures of the DJs reading this copy. And of course, DJs usually are kind of people that hate banks, right. You know, and so they would embellish the stuff. They were absolutely delighted to get ads attacking banks. In any event, the battle in Kentucky lasted some weeks, and finally it went down to defeat, and Senator Rogers is the first fellow I first saw who told me he hoped that the legislation would kill money market funds. The bill was Senate Bill 306. And this is the resolution at the end of the day that Senator Rogers introduced to retire the number of Senate Bill 306 because he was sick and tired of hearing it. And it's filled with all kinds of facetious whereases if you look at the beginning. Well, so at the end it was 28, I think, to zip. And I just mentioned one other thing, and that it was very disturbing to me. And that is we wanted to run one of our ads in the Washington Post, and it was refused on the grounds that it was scandalous, libelous, or whatever. And it wasn't really necessary that we run the Washington Post, but I really got mad and decided to put on as much pressure as we could. And, of course, we determined that advertising copy is purely on the business side. The reporters are not on the news side, and business side is separated from each other. So I said, you know, this is one of your problems. You speak to your reporters, they know all about this. And I said, well, you know, we want to have a meeting. And they finally agreed to meet with us. And I retained Harvey Pitt. This was before Harvey was chairman. He wrote a great First Amendment type brief. And we went and met with them, and I insisted, and they agreed, that there'd be somebody from the financial desk on the reporting side at the meeting. And when Harvey and made his First Amendment plea, you never saw as embarrassed a bunch of people as the Post people were, and particularly I don't remember who it was from the financial desk. They ran the ad.
Well, how did these state initiatives relate to ICI versus CAMP, which sort of took this issue around, I guess?
Well, it actually had a sort of opposite effect. We had won the case of ICI versus CAMP in 1966, which said that Glass-Steagall says the banks can't be in the mutual fund business. It certainly put a lot of pressure on the Camp decision. The banks now had an equitable argument they could make, as after they lost in the States and putting money market in business, to say, hey, look, on the one hand, you're going to let money market funds in. On the other hand, you're keeping us out of the mutual fund business. That's not fair. Our answer to that is best as we can make it. Hey, look, your problem is Regulation Q. It's not being in the money markets. Not able to have money market funds. The two did become interrelated to an extent, and it became gave the banks a somewhat better argument than they had ever had. I mentioned that before these federal hearings, that there were a whole bunch of federal regulators came in and testified against killing money market funds. The banks had also tried to convince the Justice Department that the mutual fund industry was violating the Glass-Steagall Act by going into banking. And it's one of these wonderful situations. Never ask a question until you know what the answer is going to be, because they got a devastating answer out of the Justice Department saying it was not a violation of the Glass-Steagall Act. This was not banking, because investors were at risk. If there was a default in the portfolio of money market fund, the net asset value could go down. There were shareholders. That the portfolio was managed in a way to absolutely minimize risk, there was still technically a residual legal risk, unlike a bank where you're a depositor and you're a creditor. It doesn't make any difference to you whether the bank is profitable or unprofitable. So that was pretty devastating, and also, in a sense, helped maintain the line between Glass-Steagall, between banking and mutual funds, that response by the Justice Department. Thereafter, we spent a lot of time kind of perfecting with this on a cooperative basis with the SEC, the regulation of money market funds to minimize risks of default, etc. And the vehicle was special set of rules that a fund had to comply with in order to be able to call itself a money market fund. And we presented the key was the money market fund's ability to maintain a net asset value of $1. And the way most easily to do that is to limit the maturity of the instruments that you have in the money market fund, so that they're not going to fluctuate very much, but also permit a straight-line amortization on which you can calculate net asset value rather than the tiny intermediate market fluctuations to which even these very short-term instruments might be subject, which might push the fund down to 99 cents or up to $1.01. But if you can just amortize on a straight-line basis until maturity, then you've evened it all out. That's the basic concept of money market fund regulation. And this was the very first draft of the rule, which I presented to the SEC staff. It was adopted in somewhat different form, but the principle is still there. And the rule is now 13 pages long. That's the way those things go. But that was it. That was the beginning. And so, for all of the reasons that I've mentioned so far, we devoted a lot of time and effort to the care and feeding and integrity of money market funds. So really, as I say, that rounded out the product line. And it's almost $2 trillion now, I guess, a trillion plus, with the Roth assets because of the very low interest rates over the years. But they're still the great cash reservoir. And of course, the innovation, which we didn't see on day one, but came along on day two pretty quickly, was check writing on money market funds.
Well, that was one of the issues the banks had.
Yeah, that was one of the issues. And on that one, personally, a man I admire very, very much, Paul Volcker, was against money market funds. And Matt Fink and I were over in his office one night. He wanted to talk to us about a whole range of issues, Glass-Steagall and others. And we got into money market funds. And it's wonderful how even the most brilliant among us, and Paul Volcker is one, will make a decision based on a personal observation. And his wife worked at a company or a small business, and apparently the guy that ran the company was very, very far-sighted, because what he did was get rid of his banking connection, put all the firm's cash in money market funds, and all the business's checks were written on a money market fund. So Volcker was under the impression that, you know, 80% of the country's business was now being transacted. And we kept the same as a chairman. We've done studies. It's minute. And I don't think he ever quite believed us when we said it, despite the fact the numbers didn't bear him out. Just the personal experience sometimes subsumes the objective facts. Anyway, enough about money market funds. Over the years, you know, there are a lot of other things that we could talk about, but...
Well, I want to focus a little bit on the Board of Governors case. Was this...
Camp?
And again, well, we talked about ICI versus Camp a little bit, which was in the ICI server.
Right.
And the ICI, Board of Governors versus ICI.
Yeah, there were a series of cases which were all brought by ICI. I mean, that's why it kind of confused me. Usually the plaintiff is first, but sometimes it gets reversed when the on appeal, they reverse the titles. The Camp case itself was the outcome of the Camp case itself rested to a certain extent, not wholly, but to a certain extent, on a blunder by the controller of the currency. Who was first Saxon and then Camp succeeded him. And that's why the case is ICI versus Camp. And what he did was simply by a kind of ipsy-dixit saying that banks can go into the mutual fund business through this commingled managing agency account without any rationale. And so when the case got to the court, to the Supreme Court, as a matter of fact, I think what happened is that the... Now, this goes back before my time, when the case was started, I was with the Institute and was decided by the Supreme Court, but I think I just started when the decision came down from the district court. But when the case got to the Supreme Court, read the decision closely. What they're saying is, hey, look, we've got to look at this in the most extreme, they don't use this word, but I'm just translating, in the most extreme form. This guy is just saying banks can go into the mutual fund business. There's no rationale. There are no protective regulations. He's never explained why, really, these aren't prohibited by the Glass-Steagall Act, etc. So it's sort of a naked act. And all of the inferences were drawn by the court in favor of the ICI's position because he, the controller, had positioned himself that way. Later, and we recognize that Camp was not finally dispositive.
That was my question.
And so we did not, we brought very, very few cases. It's only when we felt that we had gotten to a breaking point where if we didn't bring another case, Camp would be gone anyway, that we would bring a case. So, and what finally happened, of course, was that when the Fed got into the act, etc., and they started to write rules and rationales for those rules, and so the Supreme Court was able to distinguish the Camp case from those the later case. And so the vulnerability of Camp finally undercut it. But from the viewpoint of the fund industry, the 15 years or 20 years or so that Camp was perceived as keeping banks out of the mutual fund industry, and then the rear guard action we fought in the Congress to prevent Camp being legislatively overruled provided, I think, the needed time for an industry to grow from $20 billion, which was the size of the industry when I joined the Institute, to $1 trillion and stand on its own 2 feet and compete in the marketplace. Because I think had the Camp gone the other way, the industry would be pretty much wholly controlled by the banking industry. It is partially now through mergers and acquisitions. But there are a lot of healthy standalone mutual fund organizations.
How about insurance industry competition?
With the insurance industry, the major quarrel that the fund industry had with the insurance industry were in the areas of the variable insurance products, in which you would have life insurance, but the amount of the insurance you got would be determined by the fluctuating price of a basket of securities. There the Supreme Court ruled pretty four square on the mutual fund industry's side in that the transfer of the investment risk from the insurance company to the investor was enough to take this outside of the life insurance exemption in the securities laws and recreate this as a security. subject to SEC regulation. So once the variable products were brought under SEC regulation, although I have to say the SEC has not regulated the variable products with a heavy hand, nevertheless, the fact that it was brought under the umbrella of securities regulation makes them a competitor, but not from the viewpoint of the fund industry, an unfair competitor. That episode of variable annuities, I should have said of variable annuities because there was a later case involving variable life insurance, posing exactly the same problems and coming out the same way, not through litigation but through an administrative proceeding before the SEC. The insurance industry came in saying, this is variable life insurance, it's different than variable annuities, we should be exempt. And the SEC held a hearing, which I argued that case, which there was an evidentiary hearing actually held. And the SEC ultimately said that it's under the 33 Act. We're not so sure about the 40 Act, but it's under the 33 Act. And that brought variable life under the umbrella also. So there are a lot of variable annuity companies which are members of the ICI now. So that's long gone.
I want to talk a little bit about the organization itself, the ICI, and its growth during many years. I get got the sense from that thing that when he came in, early 70s, it was still sort of being run out of your pocket.
Right, as I said, I started in 66. The industry had 20 billion and we had 20 employees. Very symmetrical, given the odd billion and the odd employee or two. It was, though Matt's quite right, we didn't show tremendous increase in staff until later. It was the legislative fight with the SEC between 1966 and 1970 which really established the Institute's credibility among the industry. We always performed, unlike other financial trade associations, we performed all of the functions that a trade association can perform for an industry. We kept its statistics. In other industries, there are organizations which just keep the statistical information of the industry. We did their legislative and regulatory representation. And we did their public relations and industry-wide marketing, not marketing for specific companies. Whereas if you look at the insurance industry or the banking industry, you'll find that those functions are fragmented through to a number of organizations. This is not only more efficient, I believe, for the industry to do this through one organization, but each part of the organization was able to draw on the expertise of the other part of the organization. For example, in legislative matters, regulatory matters, I was able to draw upon the economics capacity and the statistical capacity directly under one roof. And I think the industry saw the advantage of keeping this all under one roof. So while there have been entrepreneurs in one area or another, either statistics or marketing, who have tried to form organizations, trade associations for the industry, by and large, they were never successful.
Has the ICI expanded in order to keep up with entrepreneurs like that? Or
Look,
services to what other people say we need to be providing?
Look, occasionally we would review what we were doing, because you sort of take it as that if somebody sees the possibility of moving into an area, let's re-examine our own programs and see that we're properly meeting the industry's needs. I think that to really get back to the ultimate bottom line here, the success of the Institute is very, very closely correlated with its ability to engage in a continuing dialogue with the SEC and other regulators as necessary. And not starting from the proposition that the government is evil and therefore must be combated at every foxhole, and fight in the streets and fight in the hills, kind of thing. But with the recognition that while the government agencies may not be right, there is most of the time some reason that they're acting the way they're acting.
Right.
And therefore, it is not only expedient, but prudent to look at what the agency is saying and to try to satisfy a public need. And we've had our arguments and fights with the SEC over the years, sometimes public and sometimes not. But the Institute, I think, has to date been fundamentally trusted by the SEC. When we say something, there's a foundation underneath it. We also have acted informally as the eyes and ears in industry for the SEC, and they're grateful for that. I mentioned in my last incarnation at the SEC that one of the things the special study found lacking was contact with the industry it's regulating, and that I think it well behooves industry to see that as a legitimate need on the part of a regulatory agency. A well-educated regulatory agency is much better than a regulatory agency that has a lot of power and doesn't understand what it's doing.
So did you deal regularly with people from the investment management division?
Oh, yes, yes.
Who were some of the folks that you dealt with?
I'd say that probably, I don't want to step on a lot of toes who are now people who are my personal friends,
sure,
but I think that all would agree with me that of the modern division, the combination of Saul Friedman, who was the first director of the modern division, and Sid Mendelson, his direct successor, probably had a unique relationship with the industry and a unique relationship with their own lords and masters up at the commission, which gave them perhaps a much greater freedom of action than some of their successors. They were long-time commission employees, going back 25 years in cases of both of them, and both very practical people who once they were convinced that a course of action, new product or new service being developed by the industry was not antithetical to the public interest or investor protection, their approach was, okay, let's see how we can do it, rather than you can't do it because Rule 30-37.5 says that you can't. Now, as I say, they may have been, not because they were the smarter than or more well-intentioned than their successors, but it may be because they had the degree of confidence arising from their long tenure at the commission. They had greater freedom of action. But basically, the division has always been staffed at the highest levels by very capable people. I mean, I go through all their names, but I would leave some out, I mean, which I don't want to do.
You were talking about providing services, you know, sort of filling out a range of services for the industry and responding to palpable needs. Is that how ICI Mutual came about? Was that something that people were saying, we really need this, do something for us, please?
Well, yeah, and nobody said you should have an insurance company, but a number of people would come to us way back in the 70s that they were having problems with insurance. Now, the statute does require a form of bonding of people in the industry. So this is sort of, this part of it is sort of directly in what you might say the traditional ICI mandate. If they're having a problem getting bonds from insurance companies, that's a problem we would ordinarily be expected to work on. But at the same time, they would have general problems with their D&O, the directors and officers liability insurance, and their errors and omissions insurance, because their complaints would be that the insurance industry doesn't understand what mutual funds are, and they lump us together with banks and S&Ls. And when the S&Ls got into big trouble, as you recall, the premiums being charged for mutual funds went way, way up. So we were getting these complaints from the industry. And as I say, we had a little experience because we had helped the industry work out certain problems with the fidelity bonds that are required by the Act. Then there would be situations where an event would fall between the cracks. It wouldn't be covered by the bond, the fidelity bond, and it wouldn't necessarily be covered by the E&O, but it might fall in between. Or if they had separate E&O and D&O policies, it could fall in the cracks between those policies. So during the late 70s or very early 80s, we had helped work out sort of a model form which combined the coverage, the E&O and D&O coverage. But that was just on an ad hoc basis. But when the real premium crunch came in the 80s with the S&L failures, we tried to approach the insurance industry and say, hey, look, we don't present this kind of risk. And it fell on deaf ears. We were told that, well, we don't really control this. The reinsurers control all this. And actually, I sent Matt to London once to talk to Lloyd's about it. And he came back saying it's pretty well hopeless. So we decided that we retained Marsh Mack to do a study for us, and they came back in option four. We didn't like the first three options. And option four was create your own captive insurance company. And that's what we did. To go on the road, we needed $40 million to capitalize the company initially on the business plan. I actually became a security salesman because the usual 80-20 rule, by the way, applies to everything in life.
Oh, yeah.
We had a meeting of the Board of Governors, and there was great enthusiasm for starting this venture until they had to put up the money, and we only got 20% of the money we needed. That's what I'm saying. And things stopped.
The rest of it was promises.
The rest were promises.
So you went out and peddled this case to the industry.
Yeah, I went made trips around the country.
What did you tell them? How did you, I mean, they must have thought that, gee, this is awfully ambitious and we don't ever be able to succeed with the insurance company.
What I think our main argument was, both sort of defensive and offensive at the same time, was, look, we can hire the insurance expertise we need. You know, actuarial science is a science. We all understand what the basic principle is, and we'll retain that expertise. Where we are experts is in the area of what will cause a loss to a mutual fund, what the legal requirements are for mutual funds, and therefore And therefore, what it is that creates liability. And our understanding of that is really critical, the critical aspect which differentiates us from the commercial insurance industry and will enable us to go to the reinsurers who are critical. You've got to get reinsurance. And that if we can go to them with a company which is now capitalized by the industry, with a trade association whose legal expertise is well recognized, we can get decent terms of reinsurance, and therefore also the fact that we're dealing with you directly and not through brokers will bring down premiums dramatically. And that was the argument with the industry and the argument with the reinsurers that did prevail. The insurance industry did their best to strangle us in the crib and not get out.
What sorts of things did they do?
Well, there's one international fund organization who for many years had wanted insurance, D&O and E&O insurance, for their offshore funds, and were unable to procure it. And one of their senior people had been a big booster of the idea of ICI Mutual. In the last frantic 3 weeks as we were trying to fill that gap. I got a call from this person saying, look, I still think this is the best thing since sliced bread, but I've got to tell you that the major insurance company in the business has come to us, told us that they would now be willing to provide insurance for our offshore funds. Can you do that? And I had to say, no, we're not prepared to do that. So in the course of that, he said, well, I have to take that to, I just really feel that I have to take it to our owner. And he came back 2 days later and he said, the boss just laughed and said, you know, go ahead with ICI. So that was, and that sort of tactic was kind of used across the board. The insurers knew what the wish lists were of various people.
Because they've been hearing it
for a long time. Yeah, so that was basically what they did. Matt and I were invited to Connecticut, one of the big insurance companies. Very genial senior vice president met us with us in his office and said, well, we've decided that you're never going to get off the ground. How about lunch? So.
And what did you think?
We accepted the lunch invitation. But we did a very, I'm not quite sure the most recent numbers, but I think that we're certainly, ICI Mutual is the largest provider of insurance, and it is the benchmark, because I do know when other companies try to sell policy to a member, it's the ICI Mutual policy that they have to shoot at.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say, you know, we're as good as, and maybe even better than ICI Mutuals.
Did you step down from the presidency of ICI to take and move into ICI?
No, I was president of both. By 1990, I had decided, well, even in 1988, I guess, for personal reasons, family reasons, I was going to retire in 1990. And that's what I did. But at the same time, ICI Mutual had been successful enough in that 3 years between 87 and 1990 that it was pretty clear the two jobs should be separated. And when I retired, which was not really planned, but as it eventuated, I was going to stay on as a part-time president of ICI Mutual, thinking that we didn't need a full-time president. So that's what happened, and I did, and it was 2 days a week, and then 3 days a week, and then 4 days a week. And finally, I found myself having to retire again in 2000.
Okay. But that's a long time to stay with that, then. You put in 10 years.
After I retired from the ICI.
Okay. Are there any other issues that we should touch on?
Well, let me just look at my... A lot of the work that the Institute does with the SEC and other regulatory bodies are not the dramatic big things like legislative combat. There was one thing that I just see. I try to get together a little list here. In 1988, just to pick this one out, we developed a standardized formula for computing yield and total return for mutual funds, one might be surprised to realize that there are about 10 different ways you can legitimately compute yield and total return. And we thought that there was a need for uniformity. We appointed a task force and then went to the SEC, and it was the result of that task force's consideration was ultimately embodied in an SEC rule. There are a lot of examples of that kind of thing where they're not philosophically controversial at all.
Right.
It's really just a question of choosing one thing or another equally good, but the vice is not choosing one thing or the other, but by having a multiple ways of doing things.
Standardization.
The clearance and settlement of transactions and that kind of thing.
A lot of this, I suppose, stems from your ability to collect information.
Yes, and also on these sort of technical levels, it's the industry is going to know a lot more about this than the regulator, because the regulator doesn't know, and the regulator legitimately doesn't know, because they're just everyday, workaday matters which are not subject directly to regulation, and there's a problem there which the industry will know about, and then we ultimately served as the conduit to the regulator, and say, okay, this is something you can take care of by a rule or a release. And there's a lot of that goes on, which never makes the press.
Not terribly sexy.
Not sexy at all.
Can you, stepping back a little bit, talk in general terms about the ICI when you came in as opposed to when you left, and how that organization has changed, and how its relations with the SEC administration?
Well, in embryo in 1966, all of the functions were there. There was a legal side, there was a statistical side, there was a public information or marketing side, if you want to call it that. However, there was no SEC relationship, really, except the ceremonial one, which I mentioned earlier. Although the ICI itself, I'm sure Matt must have gone into this, was formed out of relationships between the industry and the SEC at the time that the 40 Act was being enacted. But the relationship was pretty well severed, I think, in the wartime years. And the SEC went its way and the industry went its way, the 61 Broadway in New York, to be exact. I think that the ICI, as I say, it existed in embryo, its functions existed in embryo, and it just grew and matured with the industry it represented. The major unique function of trade association executives are to see what's going to come down the road and try to keep up with it or get ahead of the curve. In other words, I think we foresaw the growth, the potential growth of the industry, and tried to accommodate ourselves to what we perceived the coming needs to be. I once in our budgetary process 1 year in the early mid-80s. We went through the process which organizations always go through, the various divisions formulate their budget and their wish list, and it gets cut back to the higher level, and then it would come to me and then go to the executive committee of the board. And it was a period in which we thought we were going to be faced with very large growth on the part of the industry. And I bounced. We were going on a retreat where we considered the budget request. I bounced back the budget and said, okay, this is obviously a reflection of what you think you can get. Now give me a budget imposed on you, your wish list, your own wish list. And what came back was a budgetary increase of between 18 and 24%. We went over that, pretty much on that level. I went to our board and said, this is what we're going to need to staff for the future. And the board agreed. Mm-hmm. And you've got to venture
right.
Forward sometimes.
So,
incrementalism is not the road to success.
Well, you emphasize that a lot of what you're doing there is trying to look ahead of the curve, what you were doing in the position, and see, try to figure out what's coming in. Do you ever catch yourself continuing to do that and trying to figure out what's coming in?
Yeah, I do. It's interesting. I once did, in connection of being an expert witness in a tax case involving mutual funds, not particularly connected to anything we're talking about, was asked to do a history of the industry, the development of the industry. And what you see is a group of standalone mutual funds having one fund, an equity fund, and maybe having a bond fund. And this is essentially the industry I found when I came to it in 1966. And I have to say, by the way, if I didn't say this in our last session, in the special study, I was only peripherally involved with mutual funds and got into some of the commission rates and all the rest of it. But it just seemed to me that this was the wave of the future. That the sort of Merrill Lynch idea of selling everybody 100 shares of American Telephone and 20 shares of IBM was not the retail method of the future. I think I've said that before. So my career choices were colored by that. Then you saw the development of other kinds of funds, long-term bond funds, shorter-term bond funds, aggressive equity funds, the money market come later. But out of that mix, I started to see the family of funds concept. Now, I wasn't the first one to use the term family of funds. Somebody in the industry used that term. But when I heard it, I instructed our PR people, this is what we promote from now on. This is the wave of the future. And then, as I said before, the impact of technology made the family of funds concept of a really doable one. And by the way, again, technology made the money market fund possible. You could not handle the zillions of transactions on an efficient basis without technology. Also, if you think about it, the 800 telephone number enabling an investor to call the money market fund without dialing long distance had a tremendous impact on the success of money market funds.
Simple thing like that.
Yeah. So then you had the money market funds sort of completing one round of the product line. And it looked like the family of funds was going to be the be-all and the end-all of the organization of the industry. But it wasn't. Along come people like Schwab. Oh yeah, housekeeping, please. Along come people like Schwab, who now use technology to say, well, okay, you got Fidelity has this wonderful fund there, and T. Rowe Price has this wonderful fund there, and we can give you your own family of funds and the integrated account statement. You see, I didn't mention that one of the advantages of the family of funds was the integrated account statement, again made possible by technology. But now you get the Schwabs of this world saying, we're giving you your own family of funds, so to speak.
Everyone's custom name.
Right. Again, technology. The money market fund being created, brought by technology, disintermediating the banks. And sort of the rule that I've evolved out of this all is technology disintermediates and then re-intermediates in new ways. Where that carries the industry in the future, I don't know, but I do know that the present equilibrium is not the, again, the final picture of the fund industry. I think that in one way or another, funds are going to be increasingly outsourcing the advisory function. Exactly how that's going to work, I don't know. Will there be standalone advisors who do not manage money on their own, but are managing, simply providing on an outsourced basis, advice? I mean, you see this in the multiple funds that have multiple advisors now outside of competing with each other. I mean, the fund itself is, after all, just a pool of assets.
Right.
And there has to be, obviously, a very important, but still nevertheless, housekeeping function over that pool of assets. But the arrangements for managing that pool of assets can take place in a variety of ways. I think another challenge, I think a big challenge the fund industry is going to face, which the SEC has not really faced up to, is the 24-hour nature of the fund business. I think this question of pricing fund portfolios and this late trading phenomenon, I think the SEC is essentially stuck its head in the sand and its finger in the dike at this point, that the whole idea of judgmental pricing, an absence of market pricing, is the wrong way to go. I think you're going to have some form of dynamic pricing, which, again, technology will continue to enhance, and the ability of investors to come in and come out at a dynamic price as 24-hour trading becomes more and more the prevailing nature of the marketplace. We now see, New York going to buy London, is the NASD going to buy the London Stock Exchange, how will this all work? And then you think about carrying this back to the fund industry. You can see this sort of simulated pricing is not the way to go. You're going to have to plug into a dynamic marketplace and basically have a dynamic price.
Technology is, looks like it's going to be the clue to how that happens.
Yeah. The IRA that I talked about before would not have been practical without technology. The ability to manage all these small IRA accounts. There were a lot of people in the industry who said, you're crazy to go off on this. We're just going to have 2 million more accounts of $2,000. But the IRA formed the basis for the rollover IRA, in which big bucks come into the industry, which was suggested by an Institute employee up on the Hill that as a solution to the non-portability of pensions, that a pour over into an IRA, an individually owned IRA, was the way to go. It was Kathy Herring, who's now at the Capital Group in California. Also, the but technology has had most profound impact on this industry, and will continue to have it.
Much like the approach to regulation you were talking about before, it looks like in looking for change, the thing to look at is process and try to figure out what to do about the process rather than try to push some arbitrary result.
Yeah. There's one further point that I wanted to make. Just give me a minute. Yeah, the distribution is another area which is something which changes, but when it changes, that's an area which sort of remains the same. The allocation of assets between no-load and load funds sort of stubbornly remains very similar to what it's always been. There are just people who are self-starters, and there are people who aren't. There are people who have to pay a sales charge in order to get them into something good, and there are those who will go on their own. So sales charges there will be. The question is, who will be the intermediaries who bring the funds to the public? I don't know about what the future is that's tied to the future of the brokerage industry and the insurance industry, etc.
I guess in the middle of all this change, though, it's comforting to know that there's something about it that stays the same. There's the human nature represented by the need for the sales charge.
Yeah, and There's a field in the last several years which retreats from the pure market folks who say that the market will take care of everything, to a more, I think, sophisticated understanding when you start talking about behavioral economics, and that people don't always behave in the most efficient point of view from the pure market theorists. I think things like sales charges, for example, are the great example of that.
Well, it's hard to argue with that. Well, I guess that's a good place to
end. Okay.
I really appreciate your time.
I hope it's of use to somebody.